So today I'm going to talk about precession of the oscillated pulsar V1828-11, which has been monitored for the last 13 years or so by Stairs, Lyne, and Shamar. And it seems to be the first really clear evidence for precessing neutron star. And probably don't have to tell this crowd why neutron star precession is an interesting possibility. It probes the material properties of the crust, like how strong it is, how rigid it can be. It also probes the interior physics of the star, such as how the coupling of the liquid interior to the crust occurs. In principle, it probes the nature of the external torque, which would affect precession, as well as the morphology of the beam in a way I'll try to show you a little later. Also, as Kurt discussed yesterday, a rapidly spinning precessing neutron star.
And as Kurt discussed yesterday, a rapidly spinning precessing neutron star is interesting because it could be a strong gravitational wave source. Let's see if we can go to slide 2 successfully. Some observations of precession. Of course, there's the geodetic precession in the binary pulsars. That's a general relativistic effect. There are hints of precession in the Crab, Vela, and PSR1642. But the strongest evidence to date by far is this object V1828-11. And so an overview of my talk, I'll show you the data. Then I'll talk about how free precession is related to this problem. Then I'll talk about essential modifications of precession by, I'll take the dipole torque, magnetic dipole torque. I'll describe attempts to model the data, processes that could damp the precession, and some implications about the crust and liquid interior. And the collaborator with me on this project is Richard Epstein in Los Alamos. 1828 is a pretty run-of-the-mill radio pulsar. Its age is 100,000 years, its spin period is 400 milliseconds, and it's observed about 30 times a year at Jodrell Bank. These are the timing residuals versus time. This is about 13 years of data. So what this is are variations in the arrival times of pulses with respect to the average spin down. And so you see something that's roughly sinusoidal with an amplitude of about 30 milliseconds per cell. It stays nicely periodic throughout most of the span of the data until here timing noise just takes over. To model this part of the behavior, you'd have to get a new solution for the secular spin down and subtract that and model this part of the data separately. This section here is the best sample data, and that's where you can see the periodicities most strongly. And that's what I'll focus on in the modeling efforts. A blow-up of that gives this graph. These are the timing residuals. The derivative of that gives the period residuals. The derivative of that gives the residuals in P dot. The red lines are sinusoidal fits to the observed timing behavior involving a sinusoidal piece with a period of about 500 days and then a harmonic at 250 days. That gives a pretty good representation of the data. There is also a weaker periodicity present at 1,000 days. You can't really see it in P and P dot. You can kind of see it in the arrival time residuals. But the strongest periodicity is certainly 500 days. The next strongest is the 250-day harmonic. But the clincher, you might think this is due to Doppler shifts from planets, but the clincher is correlated changes in the beam width. This one's kind of hard to see. This is the beam shape, intensity versus pulse phase at two different stages. Here it's wide, and here it's narrow, and they see the beam width alternate between wide and narrow as time goes on. This graph is a measure of the beam width versus time. I'll define this parameter a little later, but the way this works is where the amplitude is small, close to zero, the beam is relatively wide, and when the beam is narrow, it's relatively high. So it's going between wide and narrow, but what's interesting is how very nicely correlated it is with the timing data, especially with the P dot data. Now, this is exactly what you would expect if the star is precessing. As it wobbles, you look into the beam with different angles. You take different sweeps through the beam. So you would expect changes in beam width correlated with the timing data as the star processes.
Ben, in order to test your system, can you go back two slides?
Sure. Watch this.
Yeah, well, actually just one, sorry. Okay, that one. So is there some reason why they didn't just make a new model, timing model, and therefore incorporate that data at the end? I mean, it seems a little weird to me that they wouldn't just, I mean, use that last bit of data that's diverging off. Was there a glitch, or was there some reason?
No, that's just the standard growth from
I guess I'm asking is they could have just made a new timing model and used the rest of that data.
Yeah, I don't know how much data they have over here. But presumably, they'd have to, if they have data, say, to here, they'd have to draw a box and fit that separately.
But I guess it's the suspicion. I mean, I'm suspicious when I don't see them using all the current data. So do they talk about the pulse shape, which doesn't depend on this in that last bit of data?
The pulse shape variations are seen through all of this data. It's really ratty in here because the data sampling is not very good. Andrew Line assures me that this is just the way they plotted things. If they take this span of the data, get a new timing solution, it looks like this.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So they must have a bigger paper.
Yeah. Okay, so the question I'm going to address in this talk is this really precession? So planets are an unlikely explanation because of the correlated beam shape changes. A really awful possibility is that part of the timing signature could arise from complicated magnetospheric processes. Just to take a simple but awful example, imagine that we've actually got some sort of precession going on. Okay, now you go out into the magnetosphere and ask how the electromagnetic field is changing. It should be changing with the precession frequency and the spin frequency and possibly harmonics of the precession frequency. So what might happen in that situation is that the emission region could change over the precession period and harmonics. So it might change in height, bringing in time of flight effects, change in intensity, in position over the star. It could be awful, and that's really no man's land because we don't really have a theory for how that would work. Also, the timing is not strictly periodic. Clearly, while we have periodicities throughout the 13 years of data, in here, this is qualitatively different than what's going on out here. So this is not perfect precession, because precession is a nice time reversible process. Here, something is changing as you go from here to here, though the periodicities are preserved. So my approach in this project has been to assume that the observed timing residuals do represent actual physical changes in the rotation rate of the star. Assume that so that we don't have any nasty magnetospheric processes introducing a signature into the timing that we can't hope to model. And I'm assuming that we do have precession going on, and I'm just going to push it as far as I can and see what it says. Okay, so Kurt did this yesterday, but I'd like to remind you yet again of what free precession is, because it's kind of confusing, and also I want to change notation on you. Sorry, the talk was prepared. Kurt spoke yesterday about the different ways in which a spinning neutron star can be oblate. It has a spin bulge, which is the largest, but that does not affect precession. It has a permanent rigidity bulge, and that is what determines precession. So just for simplicity, we can throw away the rotational bulge and think of the neutron star as a rigid rotating object with some built-in bulge. So suppose that the oblateness is, which is the difference between the moment of inertia between the largest principal axis, that is around the symmetry axis, and the moment of inertia about either of the other two orthogonal axes. This is a small number if the object is slightly oblate. If you have such an oblate object and you set it up so that its symmetry axis is misaligned with respect to the angular momentum by some wobble angle alpha, then if the object's oblate, the angular velocity is tilted off at some other angle away from the angular momentum, so that the angular momentum is between the symmetry axis and the angular velocity. These three, you can show, always span a plane. Then, if you ask, okay, let's take an instant where the plane is in the plane of the board as shown here, and ask what the subsequent motion is, well, what's the motion of any point, say, on the symmetry axis? You can get that by forming R cross omega, and you find that it moves out of the board. But since S, L, and omega all span a plane, this whole arrangement goes around always spanning a plane and just goes around L, which is an invariant axis. For a small oblateness, the angle between the angular momentum and the angular velocity is the wobble angle times this small oblateness. Now, suppose we decompose the angular velocity at some instant into its component along the angular momentum, I'll call that the wobble frequency, and its component along the symmetry axis. So two components. You could show that the angular velocity along the angular momentum is larger than the spin velocity omega of the object by some amount. So what you have is a fast motion of this object. The symmetry axis goes quickly about the angular momentum. But we have to add on a second component, the contribution along the symmetry axis, to have these two vectors correctly add up to the angular velocity vector. So there's a second motion, which is a relatively slow retrograde motion about the symmetry axis. That is, the wobble contribution plus the symmetry axis contribution adds up to the net angular velocity. Since this is down, there is a rotation backwards about the symmetry axis. So some props here. So it's kind of hard to do this with an object that's actually oblate. But suppose this represents the symmetry axis of an oblate object. So it's oblate about this axis. Let the angular momentum be up. And so we're tilted by some wobble angle, and the angular velocity will be off that way. What free precession is a superposition of two motions, a fast one, like this, at approximately the rotation frequency, and a slow retrograde motion this way, backwards, about the symmetry axis. So it goes like this and slowly rotates about its symmetry axis. Just a power plug. The magnitude of this slow rotation about the symmetry axis is approximately minus this oblateness times the angular velocity. Okay, now if you imagine looking at all this in the body frame, you jump onto the frame moving with the body so that S is fixed, you will see L and omega, which are always in a plane, move slowly in a counterclockwise fashion about the symmetry axis. And they do that at omega S. And I'll call this the precession frequency. This is the rate at which L and omega go about S in the body frame. That is the slow frequency in the problem. In the inertial frame or the lab frame, you see a fast wobble about L. Okay, so whenever I refer to the precession frequency, I mean the slow minus epsilon omega frequency about the symmetry axis. Okay, now suppose you take this object and attach to it a dipole moment. Magnetic dipole moment. They take some angle chi with respect to the symmetry axis, and you say that whenever the dipole moment is in the plane of the observer, we see a pulse. If that's the case, free precession will produce variations in the arrival times at the pulse of the pulse, depending on where you are in the precession cycle. So, prop number two. If this is the symmetry axis of our body that's oblate about this axis, and this is the dipole moment, we've got two motions. We've got the rapid wobble about the angular momentum, and then we've got the slow retrograde precession about the symmetry axis. And let's say we have a pulse when the dipole moment is pointing right at Danny. Okay, so he sees a pulse. But now, suppose we were at a different place in the precession cycle, say here, we'd have to rotate a little farther before Danny would see the pulse. Similarly, if it were over here, he would see it earlier. These timing residuals, the variations in the arrival times, are of order the wobble angle times the spin frequency, and if you do the geometry correctly, you get a cotangent of chi. Now, this is a purely geometrical effect because for free precession, the angular velocity magnitude does not change. It goes around the angular momentum without changing its magnitude. So if you take the derivative of this to get the period residuals, you see finite amplitude period residuals, even though the period, the actual rotational period, is not changing. The only thing that's changing is the difference between, in directions between the dipole moment and the angular velocity as the angular velocity moves through the body. So that said, the observations of 1828 cannot be explained by free precession. This geometrical effect I just mentioned is too small. The changes in beam width seen between the wide and narrow portions of the cycle are about 2 degrees. So you might expect that that's approximately what the wobble angle is. It's about 2 degrees. So if we take that value, also note that the duty cycle of this pulsar is very small. It's about 1%. So we can't be looking, the inclination angle between the dipole and the angular velocity cannot, they can't be too close to aligned to account for this very small duty cycle. So let's suppose the wobble angle is 2 degrees and this alignment angle is larger than about 20 degrees, then the timing residuals from free precession are less than about 6 milliseconds compared to the observed value of about 30. So free precession gives nice sinusoidal behavior, but it's just not big enough. Also, free precession gives you one periodicity. It can't explain the three periodicities seen in the problem at 1,000 days, 500 days, and 250. But, of course, we don't expect neutron stars to really be precessing freely. They're under the influence of an external torque. And for most models of pulsar spin down, such as the vacuum dipole model, the torque at any instant depends on the angle between the angular velocity and the magnetic dipole. So now if we look at this problem again, think of it in terms of free precession, where we're in the body frame, the angular velocity moves through the body, and as that, or actually it goes, the angular velocity goes about the symmetry axis, and as that happens, through one precession period, the angle between the magnetic dipole and omega will change by of order alpha. And this introduces torque changes. This occurs over the precession period and changes the torque on the star over that time scale. Often in studies of precession of neutron stars, the external torque is neglected on the grounds that it is thought to act over very long time scales, over the star's spin down age. That's not exactly true. Once you put precession into the problem, sure, you have the slow secular variations in the torque, but you also have these variations in the torque occurring at the precession period, and these have to be included.
Sorry, chi is which angle we have?
That's the angle between the symmetry axis and the dipole moment.
So I guess what I'm going to ask eventually is, what if those are the same?
If those are the same, you don't see.
The magnetic dipole is along the body symmetry axis.
Yeah. In fact, you'll see we're led to it being nearly orthogonal. Yeah. Okay, so what are the effects of the torque? The torque, as it changes as the star precesses, will drive spin rate variations. And just to get a handle on that quantitatively, the equations of motion in the object's body frame are as follows. That's conservation of angular momentum, where you get an omega cross L term coming in from the transformation to the body frame. And on the right-hand side is the torque. If you take this equation, dot it with omega, you get an expression for conservation of energy, which says that this is approximately the rotational kinetic energy of the object. It's equal to the dot product between the angular velocity and the torque. So if you have no torque, it's a conserved quantity. That's essentially a work energy theorem for a situation with rotation. So as the star precesses, and omega dot t changes, the rate at which the magnitude of omega changes will vary in time. And Ian Jones and Nils Anderson pointed out that nonlinear dependence of this dot product on the angular velocity will produce harmonics. Okay, so the model I've been exploring is that of a biaxial rigid crust afloat on a liquid core, and I treat the liquid interior as completely decoupled from the crust. The reason for that is follows. If you go back into the lab frame where the angular velocity of the body is going very quickly about the angular momentum axis, and then you put in an internal liquid which has a rotational vector at some different angle, the difference in the angular velocity vectors between the body and the liquid will vary over the star's rotation period. If internal damping mechanisms cannot enforce co-rotation between the liquid and the solid over that time scale, it'll be relatively decoupled. Well, all calculations of coupling to the liquid interior give coupling times to achieve co-rotation on the order of hundreds or thousands or more rotation periods. So to a very good approximation, we can treat the crust as floating on a core that's not doing anything, with the crust just doing its thing, processing away. Now I'll use the vacuum dipole torque mostly for illustration, but it's probably roughly correct. And the equations of motion then are the following. This is angular momentum conservation, and that's the complete vacuum dipole torque. This piece is the familiar far-field torque. M's the dipole moment, omega is the angular velocity. This is what spins down the star. And in this part is the near field torque, which has been studied in detail by Andrew Malatos. This, it turns out, does not affect significantly the precession for this situation because it acts always orthogonal to the angular velocity vector. Since it's got an omega cross M, if you take omega dot into this thing, it dies. So the near field torque, while it can change the direction of the angular velocity, it cannot change its magnitude. And this turns out to not have a large effect on the precession. So that system of equations, this one can be solved perturbatively for the resulting d omega dt. I'll just jump right to the answer rather than show the mathematics. What you find, that's some funny business going on with the math here, but the variations in omega dot with respect to the secular spin down take the following form. They go like 1 over the age, which is a measure of the strength of the torque. Then the wobble angle cotangent of the angle between the magnetic dipole and the symmetry axis. And then you've got a sinusoidal piece at the body frame precession frequency, but then a harmonic at twice the body frame precession frequency. And that is completely a result of the nonlinear dependence of the dipole torque on the angular velocity. So then if you plot these variations in omega dot for different values of this inclination angle, you get qualitatively different behavior. If the object has its dipole moment fairly close to its symmetry axis, then you get the blue curve, which is this is all arbitrary units, which is sinusoidal at the free body precession frequency, or at the body frame precession frequency. As you turn up chi and bring it to a more orthogonal rotator, take the dipole axis farther away from the symmetry axis, you start to kill off this term and bring in this harmonic term. So as you go up to a nearly orthogonal rotator, you get this purple curve, which occurs at twice the precession frequency. And for intermediate angles, you have a superposition of a fundamental and a harmonic. Now, at the same time, there's the geometric effect going on due to the precession of the angular velocity through the body, creating these timing variations at the time at which the dipole moment reaches the plane of the observer. Those effects are always smaller by a couple of orders of magnitude than this. What's happening here is actual physical changes in the rotation rate due to the torque variations, and those swamp the geometrical effects. So with that model, here's a fit to the data. This is the delta P observed residuals and delta P dot, they're both equivalent. This is just the derivative of the top one. So you get a pretty good fit to the data. The wobble angle that gives the best fit is 3.2 degrees. That's consistent with the observed beam width variations, which are of order 2 degrees. But we're led right to a nearly orthogonal rotator of about 89 degrees. The reason is the more orthogonal it is, the stronger the harmonic is, and you need to be a nearly orthogonal rotator to bring in the 250-day harmonic. So in this model, then, the precession period is 511 days. There's a harmonic at half that, 206 days, resulting from the nonlinear behavior of the torque. The model does not explain the weaker 1,000-day variation. You can get get a fundamental and a single harmonic and nothing else. Also, if it's nearly so orthogonal, you might expect to see an interpulse. No interpulse is seen for this object. However, interpulses are only seen in a small fraction of radio pulsars, and so it could be that the emission is simply not axisymmetric about the magnetic axis.
So you're making an orthogonal rotator and then you're only seeing one beam.
Which is seeing one pulse.
No, right, that's what I mean, but so you're really claiming that it's an orthogonal rotator.
Yeah.
We're looking nearly
at it.
Right, but we only see one pulse.
Right. Okay. Right. Yeah, that's essential. There's absolutely no evidence for an interpulse.
Ben?
Yeah. I've wondered about that myself, because even with, they have 13 years of data, 1,000 days is 3 years. So how much do you really believe the periodicity that's been watched for four cycles? Ingrid Stairs says they think it's real. But it's weak.
So when they use a better time solution, it's still there?
Yeah. They say that the... cutting up the data into various shorter spans, analyzing different portions, they see the same periodicities no matter what they do.
What's the magnetic field inferred for this?
5 times 10 to the 12, I think. It's a pretty run-of-the-mill radial pulsar. Okay, now what about the pulse width changes? This is a graph of the beam shape parameter that I showed earlier versus time. The definition of this beam shape is the observed beam width minus the minimum value it takes over the difference between the maximum and minimum values that it takes. So this function goes small when the beam is wide. So here and here, for example, the beam is wider than up here and up here. Okay, so how might we model that? Okay, this is only semi-quantitative. Suppose that at the time the magnetic dipole reaches the plane of the observer, and when we see a pulse, the angle between the dipole and the observer is some delta theta. The precession model predicts what that should be. Now, suppose the constant angle between the observer and the angular momentum is chi, the angle between the dipole moment and the symmetry axis, plus some small offset zeta. Because this beam is narrow, for the observer to have a chance of seeing the beam, the angle between the observer and the angular momentum has to be very close to chi. But it need not be exactly chi. It could be offset by a small amount zeta. Okay, in that case, this delta theta varies sinusoidally in that way, depending on the wobble angle and the offset. That's a prediction of the precession model. Okay, now let's suppose that the observed beam width depends on the angle with which we're looking down into the dipole. So that if we're looking right at the dipole, delta theta is zero, the beam width takes an extremum value. So I'm doing essentially a Taylor expansion of the beam width in terms of this angle delta theta and dropping the linear term and keeping the quadratic one to assure that the beam width has an extremum when delta theta is zero. Just as a model. Okay, when we do that, we get the following. Here again is the beam shape. This is a best fit to the beam shape playing that game. Here I've just shown delta P dot for comparison to remind you of how they're correlated to one another. And we get crude agreement with the data. The by tuning zeta, the offset, to be something other than zero, we get an asymmetry between the widest that it gets here, here, and here, and the second widest that it gets here, here, and here. The beam shape inferred from this is as follows. This is sweep angle versus rotational phase. So what you can think of this as a map of the beam width onto the star. As the star precesses, we go up and down by the wobble angle. But what we are forced to conclude, if this is actually precession, is that the beam is narrowest in the center of the precession cycle when you're looking very close to down the dipole. And it widens as you look at angles farther away from the dipole. So it's got kind of an hourglass shape. And I tried to show this to scale. So it gets somewhat wider. It goes from a width of about 2 degrees to about 4 degrees as you process through it. Well, that sounds a little non-standard. We traditionally think of pulsar beams as being kind of round. But Han and Manchester recently have shown in a statistical study of pulsar beams that pulsar beams are very patchy. And so just for example, contours of constant beam brightness might look something like that. Get kind of a squashed thing and with a waist.
But, I mean, the work of, say, Rankin, who showed, you know, a long time ago about for the conal emission,
The center's the core?
The core emission, right? Doesn't that correlate with the spin period in such a way that it basically tracks the open field lines? Maybe you know this.
Supposedly it's narrower.
Right.
Is Peter the 1/2?
One of them. So there's nothing known about this pulsar other than, I mean, so there's this whole phenomenology of pulsar beam shapes. Mm-hmm. So where does this one fit in? It's all core with no.
It's got a core and a conal component. Yeah. So it's the beam width has sort of a. I don't know if they would actually classify this as separate conal and core components, but the intensity looks something like that. Yeah. So that's a bit strange, but not completely absurd. But to further explore this observationally, we might do the following. Consider two places where the beam shape takes exactly the same value. So points A and B, just to take two of them. According to the precession model, those two points correspond to very different sweeps through the pulsar beam, A and B. So that if we do have some kind of patchy, splotchy beam like that, we should expect the beam with this slice to look very different to the beam with this slice. So the pulse shape should be different, even though the width is the same. And there might be differences in polarization between the two. So Stairsline and Shamar are currently working on the polarization data. But this is something to do next, a work in progress, to look for these differences in possible differences in beam shape between the different sweeps. All right, so that's the model. What might act to damp this precession? Well, let's imagine we have our body with its symmetry axis and an angular velocity vector off this direction, and we put inside it a liquid interior which has at some instant a rotation angular velocity omega L for liquid along the angular momentum. Okay, now we let these two couple over some time scale and ask how quickly it damps. Now the angular velocity of this system, because the symmetry axis is misaligned from the angular momentum, is higher by an amount of order the rotational energy times epsilon times the wobble angle squared. It's higher than that amount than if we had perfect alignment of S and L. That is, a precessing object has more rotational kinetic energy than an object that's not precessing. So because that raises the energy to be precessing, this system, if it can, will damp and eventually get to a situation where the symmetry axis and omega s are once again aligned with the angular momentum. So if it damp, if it can damp, it will. Let's let it damp against an internal liquid, and let's suppose that there exists a viscous torque between the solid and the liquid that enforces co-rotation between the two at a, over a time scale tau. That's the co-rotation time to bring omega s and omega l together. Let's say that that viscous damping is simply proportional to the angular velocity difference between the two. Then, if you look at that setup, the dissipation rate, which is proportional to omega dot s dotted into delta omega, is proportional to the rotational angular velocity over the co-rotation time times the wobble angle squared times the oblateness squared. And then if you assemble a damping time by taking the energy you want to damp, delta E, and divide it by the rate at which you're doing it, E dot, you get the co-rotation time over the oblateness, which is much longer than the co-rotation time. Or to say it another way, if you put in for epsilon, epsilon is the spin period of the precession period, so the damping time is the co-rotation time times the ratio of those two periods. Or to say it yet a third way, the damping time in units of the precession period is equal to the co-rotation time in units of the spin period. Okay. So that was an important aspect of precession that took me a while to get used to. You think if you put in a liquid that achieves co-rotation with the solid over some co-rotation time tau, then the precession should damp over that time. But it doesn't. It damps over a much longer time scale, which is generally longer than the precession period if the damping time is longer than the rotation period. So if we consider possible processes that could damp it, one dissipative process is in the core, Fermi liquid drag between the neutron and proton liquids if both are superfluid. That gives a co-rotation time on the order of 400 rotation, the damping time, the co-rotation time is 400 rotation periods or more. So the damping time of the precession would be 400 precession periods or more. That's a long time. The precession period is about 3 years, so this is 1,000 years or so. Another possibility is a viscous boundary layer at the crust core boundary. That's also very slow. That brings the entire core into co-rotation over about 10 to the 4 spin periods, so the damping time for the precession is 10 to the 4 precession periods. So, in fact, it might be difficult to damp this precession. All the dissipative processes I can think of act extremely slowly and allow the precession to persist for many thousands or tens of thousands of periods. This precession could be long-lived. It might not be necessary to excite it very often. Okay, so what is the source of the oblateness that is allowing this star to precess? Well, we require an oblateness of a part in 10 to the 8 if the precession period is 500 days. This could be supported by crust rigidity to estimate how big a mountain you can put on a neutron star and allow its symmetry axis to differ from its angular momentum axis. Suppose we put some mountain here whose weight is m mountain times g. Well, the maximum weight the crust rigidity can support is of order the bulk modulus of the crust times the critical strain angle at which it breaks over the characteristic length scale of the strain field, which is the radius of the star. The oblateness of that, the oblateness contributed to the star from the existence of that mountain is of order m mountain times the radius squared over m crust times the radius squared. Now notice I put in m crust rather than m star, because the picture is that the crust is just precessing as a shell on the liquid, because the liquid doesn't have time to respond over the wobble period. That gives an oblateness of order 10 to the minus 8 as required for a critical strain angle of only 10 to the minus 5. And 10 to the minus 5 is probably a reasonable value for the neutron star crust. And Ushomirsky, Cutler, and Bildstone do a much more accurate calculation of this. It gives essentially the same answer to order of magnitude. So it could be crust rigidity. A And then finally, I want to elaborate on a few things Kurt said yesterday about precession with and without superfluid pinning. Here's the situation we've been considering all this time. We just have a rigid biaxial crust. We haven't worried about forces from vortices perhaps pinned to the star's solid internally. But now imagine we take this object and we put in an array of vortex lines which are stuck to the nuclei of the crust. And the angular momentum of this vortex array I'll take to be along the symmetry axis, just for simplicity. It could be off some other direction, but that's harder to consider. So then, there is now, as long as these vortices are pinned, there is a contribution to the total angular momentum of the system by this vortex array, which is stuck to the symmetry axis. So in the body frame, we see an angular momentum from the pinned fluid, which is always along the symmetry axis. And because the net angular momentum is up, by definition, in order for the total angular momentum to be up, we need an extra contribution to the angular momentum, which is exactly opposite to LP in the other direction, to make sure the total angular momentum adds up to L. What that means is that the body must rotate faster about its symmetry axis to make sure all the angular momentum vectors add up correctly. The amount by which it must rotate faster is of order L pin, the angular momentum in the pin superfluid, divided by the moment of inertia of the star, approximately. But what this does, because we need this now extra rotation backwards about the symmetry axis, the precessional frequency in the body frame is driven up. It becomes epsilon, what it was before, plus the moment of inertia that's of the fluid that's pinned divided by the moment of inertia of the star. So if I pin over I is larger than epsilon, then as this star precesses, the rotation, the retrograde rotation about the symmetry axis becomes faster. We have the same superposition of two motions. We have the fast wobble, and we now have a faster retrograde motion about the symmetry axis. So that drives up the precessional frequency in the body frame. And the result is that the precessional period becomes, for I pin over I, 1% of the star, which is about what is expected for the inner crust and also inferred from the angular momentum requirements of Glitch's, we get a precession period of 100 spin periods, which would be 40 seconds for B1828 minus 11. This is completely general. It assumes nothing about the details of how the vortices pin to the star. It doesn't matter where the pinning is. It could be in the crust or it could be to flux tubes in the core. So long as there are vortices that are immobilized by something, it drives up the precession frequency to high values, which are inconsistent with observations. So the conclusion is that there certainly cannot be significant pinning in 1828 minus 11. So to summarize, the spin variations that are seen in 1828 can be explained as precession under the dipole torque. It cannot be free precession. Free precession gives an effect that's too small. The inferred precession period in the model I presented is 511 days, with a harmonic at 206 days arising from the nonlinearities in the torque. The 1,000-day periodicity is unexplained in this model. I don't know what it is. It could be slow variations in the emission region at about 1,000 days. We're led, in order to get this harmonic structure with the dipole torque, to a magnetic inclination of about 89 degrees, a nearly orthogonal rotator. There is, however, no inner pulse seen, which would require the emission to not be axisymmetric about the magnetic dipole. The inferred beam width, or the observed beam width in variations, imply an hourglass shape to the beam shape. That is one that is narrow and then widens as you get away from the dipole axis. Perhaps that could be explained by a patchy beam, but it seems a little fairly non-standard. Consideration of the damping mechanisms indicates that the precession could be long-lived. It could process for thousands or more rotation periods without being excited. And finally, significant pinning cannot be present in this object because it gives precession periods that are too short by orders of magnitude, or conversely, if vortex pinning occurs, this is not precession. Okay, thank you. I think precession's involved, but I don't think it's very simple. I think that, back up here.
You have a considerable part of your career.
yeah, I do. So I said once at coffee that if this object glitches, I'll have to quit the field. There's clearly something more than just precession going on here. I don't know what it is. Is it being forced? Is the torque? Is there something complicated going on in the torque that's forcing this? Could it be something changing in the magnetosphere? Or another possibility, suppose... Yeah. So the something that might be occurring is that the star is having constant, fairly random perturbations to its figure from star quakes, say. Okay, if that's the case, imagine you're in the body frame of the object so that you are always fixed with the symmetry axis of the body. As these perturbations occur, what you'll see is the angular velocity take random jumps to other locations in the object. And then it'll process for a while, and it'll take another jump, and it'll process for a while. And that might produce behavior like this. In fact, I've looked at this a little, and I found that yes, this looks like a superposition of three sinusoids with periods of 1,000 days, 500 days, and 250 days. But to get from here to here is consistent with changes in the amplitudes and phases of those three sinusoids. And that's probably what would happen if you were to give random perturbations to the angular velocity vector in the body from perturbations to the star's figure. As for the vortex pinning question, if this object were to glitch, then we'd be forced to conclude that glitches have nothing whatsoever to do with vortex pinning, as vortex pinning doesn't occur, at least in this object, and cannot explain glitches in this object if it glitches.
But then you also have to explain why pinning occurs in some object is not glitch.
Yeah.
What's the difference between the signal star and the glitching control
star? Well, we of course don't know why. A similar question might be, why are so few stars processing?
Right.
And it could be that there's something about the processing stars that prevents vortices from ever being pinned, and therefore a prediction in a vortex pinning model would be that they could never glitch. It could be that the precession is somehow keeps exciting the vortices so that they can't pin. I'm exploring with Richard Epstein the possibility that vortex pinning is a bistable state, that there are situations where you can have pinned vortices essentially at the temperature of the lattice, and those stars can glitch, and that you can have another situation where the vortices are essentially free of pinning sites, moving dissipatively, being constantly excited so that they can never repin. And the prediction would be that those stars could never glitch, but they could execute long-period precession. Now, in objects that glitch, if they have vortex pinning, and if they're precessing, it would be very hard to see the precession because it's so short. I don't know how that would look observationally exactly. For this object, you'd expect about a 40-second precession period, and that might just look like noise in the timing data.
Yeah.
But what's lacking there are nice correlated changes in beam shape seen to accompany it.
What are the periods?
A couple of years. Yeah. So if that's precession, no pinning. Yeah. There's no question that.
But this is like a million years old, 100,000.
100,000. Yeah.
So I mean those do glitch from 10 to 5 years.
Yeah. Old. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, what was the peak of activity around 10 to 4 years? I mean, sort of, I remember glitching was prevalent.
Yeah, 10 to the 10^4, 10^5.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the if and a lot of the objects that are at 10^4, 10^5 years glitch every few years or so, and this one has been watched for 13 and hasn't glitched. But if it does, that would be extremely baffling.
Is it conceivable that the vortexes, there are vortexes there that are pinned, but enough of them that are implied positive angular momentum is negative angular momentum, so that you actually have your arrow in this along the symmetry axis short. In other words, imagine you start with a fluid that's convective, it has motions on many scales, and suddenly, instantly, you turn its rotation into a vortex representation such that it has zero total angular momentum but lots of vortices.
Then it's not rotating.
Right, and then you can have your pinning and your precession at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, but but such a liquid has no rotation.
Right, what I'm saying is the fact you could have individual flux vortex lines pinned, but no net rotation for the the superfluid interior.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get precession. I don't know, maybe it's a fine-tuning sort of.
I think it'd be hard to get into such a state because the liquid's in a rotating vessel. It wants to have angular momentum. And it's energetically favorable for it to be, its most energetically favorable state is one of co-rotation with the container. So to set up vortices in the opposite direction to cancel out rotation in this direction costs a lot of energy. And it doesn't minimize the energy of the system. But even if you could engineer such a state, for that to be the case, for it to be consistent with observations, let's go over here. What you need is, well, the observations of 1828, which give a precession period of about 500 days, require epsilon of 10^-8, so that this term, I pin over I, has to be less than 10^-8. So you can have pinning, it just has to be very small. And 10^-8 is just uninterestingly small for explaining glitches in other objects. If you now have pinning in this direction and add some vortices going the other direction, which cancel it out, you really need cancellation to a part in 10^-8. I think it's difficult to do with the precession itself. The reason is, looking up again, let's see here. Let's go. That'll do. If you imagine pin vortices in the shell precessing with this container of pin vortices, the angular velocity that is flowing past the fluid flowing past the pin vortices varies fractionally by alpha epsilon. And for this object, that's very small. Alpha is 10^-2 radians, epsilon's 10^-8. Yeah, that's MeV or some fraction of an MeV per pinning site, the pinning. So yeah, I could do that in a few minutes after the talk. But are you thinking of taking the excess energy in the precession and using it to unpin vortices? Yeah. That'd be an interesting number to look at. Yeah.
Great. Thanks for that.